friends as the most common way to find a romantic partner.
Friends have been society's prime matchmakers since they displaced parents back in the 1940s. But Michael Rosenfeld of Stanford University says their influence is now rivaled by the internet. His latest study finds nearly a quarter of romantic partners meet online, and that's easing a social stigma.
It used to be that people who met online had a separate story that they thought was more palatable. It seemed a little seedy and unseemly. And for some reason, people used to think that it was more upstanding to say I met them in a bar.
Rosenfeld says the smaller the dating pool, the more important a role the internet plays. His study finds a whopping 60% of same-sex couples meet online. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
Neuroscientist Susan Berry was cross-eyed since infancy, unable to see in three dimensions.
The snow would appear to fall in one flat sheet. I did not feel like I was part of the snowfall, but I was looking in on the snowfall.
After intensive training, she sees differently.
All of the snowflakes produce this beautiful three-dimensional dance.
Berry's book is called Fixing My Gaze. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson and Jason Croft, is at the board this morning. I'm sorry that we aren't able to make contact with the guest that we had scheduled for this morning. We will see if we can do that on another day. We're set up to talk with Jacob Hacker. He's a political science professor at Yale, and we'll be talking, when we get that show on, about the Economic Security Index. This is a measure that he helped to develop that shows what's happening with financial security or insecurity in America. And so we'll see if we can get that scheduled for another day. Instead, we'll go to the Focus Archives for a past program. So for just this hour, we'll not be taking calls. Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about wisdom. It is something that seems to be easy to recognize, at least if we went out and we asked people, can you give us a list of individuals that you think are particularly wise? I think they would be able to do that. Then, though, if we said, now, what exactly does it mean to be wise? What about them makes them wise? What is wisdom? That becomes more difficult. And certainly that is a question that thinkers of various kinds, theologians and philosophers, have been wrestling with for a very long time, and to this day, there seems to be no real consensus on the definition of wisdom. It is the case, however, that psychologists are taking a look at wisdom and trying to figure out what it's all about, whether we actually can acquire wisdom in some sort of deliberate way. What are the things, the life experiences that actually make us wise? This morning in this part of Focus, we'll look at some of these questions. Our guest will be Stephen Hall. He's a science writer. He's written for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is titled Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience. It's published by Knopf, and it's just out. And it takes a look at some of the psychological research looking at wisdom, and indeed tries, at least, to ask some questions about wisdom and what it is, how it develops, and whether, in fact, there are things that anyone can do to cultivate wisdom. And Mr. Hall, hello.
Hi. Good to talk to you this morning.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. I understand that this really began with an article that you wrote for the New York Times Magazine, and that when they contacted you and said something like, well, we're interested in having you write an article about scientific research, serious scientific research into the subject of wisdom, you, although apparently you didn't say it at the time, you kind of rolled your eyes and you thought, scientific research on wisdom, how could such a thing even be possible?
Yeah, I was deeply skeptical. If you know some of my other work, I've been a journalist who's covered science for nearly 30 years now, and most of it's been pretty nuts and bolts science, with molecular biology and genetics and immunology and things like that. So when I was my editor from the Times magazine called up and said we'd like you to do a story about research into wisdom, I was deeply skeptical about it. It didn't strike me as a very hard topic to write about. And frankly, I didn't have a lot of great expectations that the piece would ultimately run, because I found it hard to believe that something as amorphous and fuzzy a concept as wisdom would lend itself to kind of serious and interesting research. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I did not express that opinion to my editor at the time, and I said I would agree to look into it a little bit. And she sent me some background stuff in terms of people who had published. And what really fascinated me was I started to go through the literature, and I realized that it's about in the 1970s that a small group of pretty well-established psychologists, both in the United States and in Europe, decided to tackle this subject. And interestingly, it kind of grew out of the field of gerontology a little bit. And the thought was the following. For decades, a lot of gerontological research and energy was expended on chronicling basically the mental and physical declines that are associated with aging. And so it was a very bleak picture of sort of what happens as people get older and their cognitive functions begin to decline as well as their physical capabilities. And there were a couple of psychologists who said, why don't we look for things that are maybe a little bit more positive? And one of the leaders of this movement was a professor at a professor of gerontological psychology at the University of Southern California named James Beeren. And he kind of turned loose a bunch of his graduate students on subjects like wisdom, creativity, love, really big picture, fuzzy ideas, but with the notion of maybe there's some good things associated with aging that we can get a handle on through looking at these things. And one of his graduate students, Vivian Clayton, ultimately became the first psychologist sort of in the modern era to publish studies on wisdom, and that kind of got the ball rolling.
Yeah. Wisdom has certainly long been the province of philosophers, theologians. I suppose one might ask, why should psychologists be interested in this? What can they bring to the discussion?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think philosophy has always been dedicated to the idea of defining wisdom as kind of an abstract idea. And theology, to a certain extent, it's interesting in the theological literature and in the Bible, you have kind of have two aspects of wisdom, one of which is kind of a code of behavior and proper conduct and way to think about life, which philosophy also addresses. But part of wisdom in the biblical tradition is also the fear of God. And you know, wisdom begins with the fear of God, as in Proverbs. So you have this sense of proper behavior, but it's not sort of broken down into temperament, different aspects of what goes into wise decision-making. And what made the psychological work so interesting is that they began to assemble a series of capabilities, behaviors, traits that they associated with wisdom. And I should also add that Erik Erikson, the famous 20th century psychologist, was the first. He didn't do any research on wisdom, but he's kind of the first to put it on the plate of psychology in the middle of the 20th century, actually, because he suggested that wisdom was one of the characteristics of the eighth or last stage of life, and how he defined the eight stages of human development. And so the psychologists went in and they started to define qualities that they associated with wisdom. And they're not the things that necessarily philosophers talked about all the time, although anecdotally they did. I mean, one of them was sort of what's called emotional regulation now, or sort of basically controlling one's emotions in order to reach the best decisions. And that is a thread that runs through Montaigne and Socrates and all the way to the beginnings of philosophy. But coming at it from a psychological angle, you could begin to think about how do you do experiments, how might one test this, And that kind of brings us a little bit more into the present. But in fact, there is a lot of psychological research and neuroscience research now into what's called emotion regulation. Mm.
So what the field of psychology seemed to get around this definition problem by approaching it in a different way, by saying something more like, well, what do we think are the qualities of the wise person? And can you take a look at those things?
Exactly. And so, and basically what I did in the book, well, let me back up a bit, because one of the really interesting processes, as I mentioned before, I basically have written about very hardcore genetic science and all that stuff. So suddenly I'm reading about decision-making and delayed gratification and limitations in knowledge and how people deal with uncertainty. And although I understood that these were not entirely well-defined concepts, I also found that they were really interesting and intriguing things to think about. And as I was doing this background research, I found myself engaging in kind of what I began to think of as armchair mindfulness, in the sense that I would read a definition of wisdom from the psychological literature, and then increasingly in psychology and in philosophy, and I just would start to think, how does this apply to my life? How do I reflect this? And the bottom line was, I began to think about what constitutes wise behavior in my own life, with all the sorts of quotidian issues that we deal with family, children, workplace, our aspirations, our delayed gratifications or impulses. And I realized that, thinking about wisdom is a really important thing to do, and that we really don't set aside much time to do it. And it really requires a kind of deliberate reflection on the choices that are in front of us in our lives, or the conflicts or dilemmas that we face, and what's the best way to go about dealing with them. So in the midst of doing this research for the magazine article, I found an incredibly invigorating process of kind of self-examination, thought, taking a deep breath and sort of stepping back to see problematic situations and how I might deal with them. And that's when I really got intrigued with the idea. I thought, this is really useful, and this is something I don't normally take time for in my everyday life. And I don't think people typically do have time to do it, but even though it's really important to do so.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Stephen Hall. He's a science writer. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, has authored a number of books, and his most recent, the one we're talking about here, is titled Wisdom from Philosophy to Neuroscience. It's published by Knopf, and it looks at this question: what is wisdom? What are the qualities of the wise person? Can they be studied? Are they subject to some kind of scientific analysis? Can we learn how they work, and maybe can they be cultivated? Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We can talk some more about the research, but I think it's interesting that it seems to be the case that now over time it has become a more acceptable kind of thing for a psychological researcher to say that they're interested in wisdom.
Well, interestingly enough, there was a paper that just came out about 2 months ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences out of the University of Michigan, which is a very specifically a wisdom-related psychology study, and basically assessing how people analyzed, perceived, and then kind of understood a particular situation of conflict. And the bottom line of that particular study was that older people seemed to have a better perceptual grasp of some of the issues at play and how one might think about them than middle-aged people or younger people. It has gotten a bit more respectable. Interestingly enough, I turned in my draft of the book in March of last year, so that was March of 2009. 1 month later, there was an article in a journal called the Archives of General Psychiatry, which is a well-respected scientific journal, with the title The Neurobiology of Wisdom. And to my knowledge, it was the first sort of linkage of neuroscience to wisdom sort of in the modern setting. And it was kind of concurrent with my finishing up the book, and it talks, in fact, about many of the same researchers that I discussed in the book. The point being that there was not even a conversation about wisdom and neuroscience even a couple of years ago, but If you parse the idea of wisdom down into some of these component parts, which is kind of what I did for the book, and then look to see if there's any significant science being done at the level of brain science, I was both delighted and surprised to find that there's a lot of research that I think is really quite relevant to wisdom, and very hopefully suggests also that sort of mental exertion, in the same way that physical exertion builds muscle, that mental exertion perhaps can help us attain some of these qualities that give us a better chance of being or exercising wisdom, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting notion that you suggest, that we're coming to the understanding that exercising the body for a number of reasons, this is a good thing. And so we're trying to build that. At least some of us are trying to build that into our lives. The interesting thing I think that you're suggesting is that maybe now in the years ahead, we're going to think more and more about or come to a greater appreciation of the fact that and I don't just mean things like working crossword puzzles, you know, things that keep your brain active, a particular kind of mental conditioning. Maybe we're going to come to understand that more and think that that's an important thing and try to find ways to do that.
I can give you two examples that I think are very relevant in precisely that area. One is compassion. And if you go back, I'll tell you a little bit about the process of how I decided on some of these things. I went back after I did the magazine article. I was approached asked to do a book. I wasn't convinced that there was enough neuroscience that would warrant expanding it from a magazine article to a book. So I just started to do a little bit of due diligence and sniffing around. One of the really interesting areas of research was in the area of compassion. And if you go back again in the ancient literature, whether it's Greek philosophy or Buddhism, for example, or Confucianism, compassion, empathy, fellow feeling, however you want to put it, is a really important and critical element of how people defined wisdom sort of historically. There's a scientist at the University of Wisconsin who's been studying the neural correlates of compassion. And what he's done is, and this has actually been a kind of a general theme of recent neuroscience research, you identify people who are exemplars of a particular quality, and you actually study their brains. So if you're interested in memory and geographical memory, they've done studies of taxi drivers in London. And if you're interested in muscle memory and music, you study musicians. In this case, he was interested in compassion, and so he's been flying for about 10 years now. Buddhist practitioners from India to Madison, where they've been undergoing a series of experiments to see what's going on in their brains as they're meditating and doing specifically compassion meditation. And over the course of these studies, and they published about two or three studies now on this, they've discerned a very specific, different kind of mental activity that is associated with compassion in these monks. In fact, they've worked out a kind of circuitry that combines and actually reflects at least from what I've been told, some Buddhist elements of compassion, one of which is to be able to perceive another person's suffering, so there's a perceptual part of this, to kind of somatically in your own body feel that suffering in the sense of empathy. And then also the third component is action, that is to do something to relieve the suffering. These are all kind of very standard pillars of activity and compassion in Buddhism. And they've been piecing together this brain circuitry that reflects these three parts of the process. And it's clear that, you know, for people who have practiced, and these are meditators who have meditated for tens of thousands of hours, their brains are different. They process information differently. They have a electrical activity in their brain called a gamma oscillation, which is hypothesized to kind of coordinate activities in different parts of the brain, which is associated with their general sense of what's kind of called a panoramic awareness when they're in the midst of compassion meditation. So it's a good example of taking a concept that's really fundamental to many schools of wisdom or many definitions of wisdom, and then kind of looking under the hood of the brain and seeing what's going on as it's happening. And that work has been pretty influential because other people, pretty well-known people in neuroscience, are now also looking at compassion. So it's kind of opened a window into this one element of wisdom. Mm.
Just one other quick follow-up, and then I have a caller I want to get to. I think that it is true, if you look at how people have thought about wisdom over a long time, that there seems to be this notion one way or another that wisdom is something that almost is something that you're born with. And something like thinking about it in the way that this research suggests makes me think that really the components of wisdom, the qualities of the wise person, really are in many ways learned behaviors. Yes?
Yeah, I would agree. In fact, I would say they are cultivated behaviors or cultivated traits. Hmm. I would also say that part of this is circumstantial, that some people are raised in circumstances which for one reason or another, perhaps increases the odds of their acquiring some of these traits that are useful in terms of wisdom. But I think the point is well taken, and I think one of the reasons wisdom has always been associated with a later stage in life is that part of the knowledge that guides wisdom, of course, is just based on the accumulation of life experience, and obviously we have more life experience as we get older, which is not to say older people are wiser or likelier to be wiser, because there are also examples of young people, and in fact, there have been some studies in Europe, very interesting, that seem to suggest that the roots of wisdom can be located not in later stages of life or even middle age, but probably earlier, like young adulthood or even late adolescence.
And this is really what's really interesting. And again, some of this research points to the fact that adversity in early life, if you have a rough time when you're young, that actually seems to be, of course, it can be hazardous, and there is research looking at why it is that some people thrive under adverse conditions when they're young and some people don't. But overall, there seems to be some good reason to believe that that kind of early experience actually can contribute to the development of these things that we are talking about.
Yeah, and one of the fascinating things to me was I went back, and this is all kind of anecdotal, but a lot of the founders of various fields of philosophy, some of the most notable figures that we associated with wisdom, all had some aspect of adversity fairly early in life. Aristotle stuttered, had a speech impediment. Moses stuttered. The Buddha lost his mother within a week of when he was born. Gandhi, almost pathologically shy person as a child. Confucius was kind of shy. His father died when he was three, and he was later shunned from various jobs and so on. If you look at many of these examples, you see that there was an early exposure to adversity that these people were able to overcome. And the suggestion is that somehow that contributes to this notion of being able to regulate one's emotions, not get too high, not get too low, be able to respond to upset or unexpected events without flying off the handle and that sort of thing. And that seems to have contributed, in a sense, to the kind of good decision-making that's associated with a lot of these people.
All right. Let's talk with the caller here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Well, it seems to me sometimes it's wise to be angry, so... talk shows are my mental gymnastics, I guess, so I guess I hope it's doing some good. It's probably unwise to be doing it while you're driving, though, but all that is a frontispiece there. But what do you do about a couple of things in the methodology, I guess? The Indian proverb, Native American proverb, is white men clever but not wise. How do you say what is clever and what is wise? Some people have an idea of wisdom. To use another loaded example, I guess Rand Paul thinks Ayn Rand is wise. How can you actually, something as nebulous as this, the business about compassion that I also wanted to comment on, are these same researchers studying like sociopaths, people who are entirely non-empathetic, to see if there's any kind of broad neural structure that looks the other way, or that something that they could draw from that? That's a lot, I realize, but I guess I do want to hang up and focus on the matter at hand.
Thanks for the questions.
Let me answer that second question first. Yeah, there's been a lot of work on sociopaths. In fact, kind of one of the ironies is that an enormous amount of research effort has been devoted to sort of the negative variants on these kinds of behavior, and almost none until very recently on the positive aspects of the behavior. So there's been a lot of a study of violent behavior, non-compassionate behavior, unfeeling behavior, that sort of thing. And only recently has there been more attention to sort of the more positive flip side of that. So that's an important component just in terms of expanding the palette of things that researchers are taking a look at. And the first part of the question was...
Well, I think it was essentially, I think what the caller was raising was the distinction between wisdom and intelligence.
Oh, right. Okay.
How do those two things relate, if at all?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question. And in fact, it explains the career of one of the main people in the field, a guy named Robert Sternberg, who was at Yale University for about 30 years. Is widely known as an intelligence researcher. I mean, he had a theory of intelligence and developed a lot of methodology surrounding that. And one of the things that he realized ultimately was a shortcoming in this theory of intelligence is it did not account for the fact that people could be very intelligent and nonetheless do very socially disadvantageous or negative things, kind of separating intelligence from a spirit of doing things for the common good, to which he attaches wisdom as opposed to mere intelligence. And so you have a component, and in the book I talk about it as altruism, where you have this kind of situation where people basically engage in self-denying acts which nonetheless promote the welfare of a larger group. It's become a very important biological concept and is the subject of very intense research right now. A group in Germany who studied wisdom a long time made a very interesting point in the difference between intelligence and wisdom. When you test for intelligence, you give people an examination, you quantify it. There are right answers and wrong answers to the questions that you ask, and they can be marked, and therefore a measure can be determined. In wisdom, they point out, there are no right answers. And the reason for that is that wisdom is very contextual, so that what's the right answer in one situation or in one time or one place may be the absolute wrong answer in a different setting. And that's why the bar for wisdom and frankly, the fuzziness of the definition is a little bit more challenging, because it's this ability to sort of perceive how the context and situation is different or requires a different response in a different situation. So it's a very good question, and I think the point is that intelligence is part of wisdom, and certainly in terms of the knowledge base, but it goes beyond that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Stephen S. Hall, is a science writer. He's written for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of a number of critically acclaimed books, including Invisible Frontiers and Merchants of Immortality. He's won a number of awards for his work. And his new book is Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience. It's published by Knopf. And it looks at wisdom, looks at some of the attempts that people have made to define it, some of the qualities that seem to be exhibited by people we consider to be wisdom, and then some of the scientific research looking at those things to try to see if we can understand what really is going on, what these things are all about. And the book is out now if you want to read it. Just to go back to pick up a point that I think is interesting, if you look at many of the individuals who are consistently on lists over time of wise people, it seems to be the case that a lot of these people in their times were trouble. They were regarded as rebels, as mavericks. They challenged the established system. The established system often did not appreciate them and what they had to say very much. Does that tell you something about wisdom?
Well, I think that was actually one of the most fascinating things about thinking about these exemplars of wisdom through history. I think it tells you that it's very difficult for us to sometimes identify, you know, publicly wise people in our midst, because they're going all the way back to Socrates and what's arguably the most famous trial, in the, certainly in the history of philosophy, but possibly in the history of Western thought. Socrates had a very adversarial relationship with his society, in fact, was put to death for it. If you look at the example of Gandhi, there was clearly a rejection of the prevailing values of his colonial society in which he lived at the time. Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, who are often figures who are more contemporary figures who are mentioned as exhibiting wise behavior, similarly were adversarial, at least toward aspects of the societies in which they lived. And Jesus Christ clearly was very adversarial to the prevailing values of the society in which he lived. So in retrospect, we can see the wisdom that each of these people brought to bear on their particular societies, but also that these attitudes were kind of in opposition to the prevailing values of those particular societies. So there's something about wisdom. There's a price to be paid for clearly perceiving what's the perhaps the correct code of behavior or thought in a given situation or a given society, a given time. The more contemporary example in terms of racial discrimination and segregation in this country was clearly the wrong value and nonetheless persisted until wise and courageous people brought it to our attention that this was not correct and needed to be rectified.
We talked a little earlier about the difficulty of defining wisdom, but what you can do is you can look at individuals that you consider to be wise, and then you can say, well, what are these people like? Well, what are the aspects of their character? How do they live? And from that emerge a number of qualities, kind of the things that you talk about in the book as the eight neural pillars of wisdom, these things, and you mentioned some of them, like being able to keep yourself emotionally on an even keel, and compassion, and altruism, and then there are others that seem to, if you look again across time at different traditions, different ways of thought, different systems of thought, and people who seem to be the exemplars of that, there does seem to be a relatively small and fairly consistent list of qualities that come out.
Yeah, one of the things I tried to do when I was kind of doing a historical survey and looking at the various religions and philosophical schools, I was more interested in the concurrences, where they agreed. Mm-hmm. There's certainly disagreement in between various schools, and Buddhism, for example, tends to kind of discourage the emotional connections between family members a little bit. I mean, that's part of the Buddha's renunciation of his family in terms of in his search for enlightenment. But I was looking for things that where I found kind of concurrences, where there was an agreement across different areas. And I settled on, somewhat arbitrarily, but I think it was very useful as just as a construct to talk about these things, you know, these eight pillars of neural pillars of wisdom. And that is eight traits that kept coming up in different settings that where there's some substantial neuroscience going on. So one of them was emotional regulation, sometimes can be considered resilience, the art of coping, how you deal with negative events and overcome them. This notion of making a judgment, but how, you know, what goes into establishing values so that you can choose the right thing. Robert Nozick, a philosopher at Harvard, has said, defined wisdom simply as knowing what's important. And knowing what's important in all sorts of different ways is crucial to making decisions. And so there is a neural process that assesses or attaches value to decisions, and that's a really important component. So there's a lot of neural work on decision making. Moral reasoning has been found to have a brain component, and moral decision making and moral judgment is a really critically important part of wisdom. Compassion, which we talked about already, Humility, there has not been a lot of science, but psychology is starting to get into humility, and it's very much associated not only with this idea of accepting limitations on what we know or what we can know, but as part of that accepting limitation, being open to different sources of information, being open to being contradicted, in other words, allowing one's habits to be challenged, which is another important component, altruism, which we talked about before, patience, which, again, there have been some brain studies recently of showing people weighing the decision between getting an instantly gratifying reward or delaying getting the reward when it will be a little bit larger if you wait a little bit longer. And there's a kind of a contest inside the brain for which of these two impulses will prevail. And it's a really interesting part of neuroscience now, but it's really clearly a very important part of how we all approach decisions in our lives and our children's lives and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And dealing with uncertainty is a really change. The human brain, I think, is so remarkable because it's capable of adjusting to a constantly changing environment. And that's, I think, why we've been evolutionarily such a successful species. But it really requires a kind of nimbleness at the neural level to both perceive a situation that's changing and understand how we need to change our behaviors to adapt to it. And we deal with change every day in all our lives. So it's a really important component of thinking about wisdom and how we deal with that. And I should add, all these, you know, emotional regulation being even keeled is really important to dealing with uncertainty. That there's a kind of web that connects a lot of these different qualities that I think help us approach a situation and give us a chance to arrive at maybe the best decision or the best course of action.
And that, I think, is an important point. One of the things that you explain, try to remind people that what science does is they approach a very big and complicated problem and try to break it down into smaller pieces that you can get a handle on, and then perhaps also think about how can you design some sort of experiment to look at that. And what I think is important here is the idea that wisdom is maybe not, it's not just having one or two or three or all of these qualities. It also has something to do with the way that they work together.
Absolutely. I think it's that notion of the kind of, I won't say symphonic, but there's a quality of all these different qualities working together, again, to allow one to respond to a situation in a wise manner. And sometimes I think it's helpful to not think of people as being wise necessarily, but capable of wise behavior in certain situations. I mean, another part of this is that wisdom is really kind of an ideal. It's that we all aspire to it, strive to achieve it, rarely achieve it. That's part of the limitation that we have to approach the topic with. But that at least in certain circumstances and certain situations, we may have an opportunity to exercise wisdom in a way that benefits, you know, our families, ourselves, and enables us to, you know, utilize our potential to the greatest degree.
Let's talk with another caller here. Belgium, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. The question I want to pose to you is this. Many, many times throughout history, we have assumed that somebody was wise, and they're not. In other words, we'll see somebody with a large head and a lot of hair and say, oh, this guy's got some kind of facts in his mind that we should aspire to. Have you ever thought about that aspect of it, that who we think are wise are not actually wise?
Are you saying this more or less contemporaneously, like people in our midst that we think?
Well, no, just all the way through history, and it happens today, too.
Mm-hmm. Because I think, for example, you know, the names of people who appear on these lists, like Socrates and Gandhi and the Buddha, Confucius, Jesus. I think those are generally recognized exemplars. The more interesting issue, which your question touches upon, is can we only define wisdom by looking back at people who exemplified it, as opposed to looking forward and seeing lives that are kind of embodying it as they move forward. And that's actually an interesting scientific question that scientists gave a talk up at Brown University a couple of weeks ago, and somebody raised precisely that point. How do you kind of is there a way around identifying it only retrospectively? Can you prospectively, looking forward, sort of see qualities that will predict wise behavior later on in life? It is easy to mistake. One of the really interesting things that's come up in a number of the discussions when I've given talks about this is this kind of dual notion of a public wisdom and a private wisdom. That is, a wisdom that plays out on a public stage, which is the kind that would be associated, for example, with a Gandhi and Abraham Lincoln, for example, figures that are Nelson Mandela, figures that are associated with wisdom, but because of their actions on a kind of public stage. And they tend to be, interestingly, primarily male. And then there's the kind of a private arena of wisdom or wise behavior, wise counseling, often takes place in a kind of familial setting. Matriarchs are very important in this definition of wisdom. Family members, parents, grandparents, that sort of thing, none of whom leave a paper trail, none of whom give speeches before Congress, none of whom write books necessarily, but nonetheless, through the example of their wisdom and through the example of their behavior, make an indelible impression on subsequent generations and, in fact, are imparting wisdom kind of at the retail domestic level.
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah. Maybe put a slightly finer point on it. Maybe my example might not be as wise as I'd like it to be. During World War II, you know, a substantial portion of people in Northern Europe thought Hitler was pretty smart.
Right.
And he's not.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, but the Hitler example is the one that Robert Sternberg often uses to separate intelligence from wisdom, Hitler satisfied all his definitions of intelligence, but does not satisfy his definition of wisdom, because what he did was not for the common good and, you know, sort of an elevating humanity as opposed to segregating it, destroying part of it, all the issues that we could talk about.
Thank you very much.
All right. Our guest in this hour of focus is Stephen Hall. He's a science writer. The ideas that we're here talking about, you will find in his new book. It's titled Wisdom from Philosophy to Neuroscience. It's out now, published by Knopf. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. To go back to something that you touched on, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about it. There seems to be more and more interest in looking at those things that make us human and thinking about how it is those qualities developed and whether or not the reason they developed is that they had, over time, had survival advantages. They helped us as a species get to where we are.
Right.
Do you think that there is, can you make the argument or do people make the argument that there is, in fact, some survival advantage to wisdom?
Yeah, I would definitely. It's interesting you raise that question, because there was an additional chapter in the book which we elected ultimately not to include just because of length purposes. But it was kind of talking about the evolution of wisdom or the evolutionary value of wisdom, and I think a lot of it probably goes all the way back to the origins of social cooperation. By which I mean which behaviors enabled a group, could have been a family, probably a larger group of either what are referred to as early modern humans, so we're talking maybe half a million years ago up to as recently as 50, 40,000 years ago. What kinds of behavior enabled one group, like the modern humans, to survive as opposed to Neanderthals, for example, who were living at about the same time. And one of the suggestions is that the humans probably had slightly more advanced social cooperative skills that could have enhanced all sorts of things, from getting food, a trade. Trade allowing new ideas and new technologies to be exchanged, child care, social cooperation in terms of child care, which might have increased infant survival, which can be an important factor. There's a lot of issues at play, and it hasn't been thought about a huge amount in the context of wisdom, but in terms of social cooperation, it's being thought about a lot. And I think there is a wisdom component to this. What's best, and it's an altruistic component to it too, what's the best thing for the group, not necessarily for the individual or even the family, although that helps perpetuate the genes of the family into the future, but what's the best thing for the group's survival? So I think that's a really important component of this.
We have now just about 5-6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get everybody in, and we'll start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
My question is a simple one. In a conversation like this, I would have expected the word culture to be part of the conversation because it appears, looking at different parts of the world at the moment, that it's not clear to me that what is considered wisdom is uniform around the world.
Is that the question?
Yeah, I mean, what part does culture play in this?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Culture clearly plays an important part. And when we talk about Buddhism and parts of the culture of Buddhism and the different aspects of it, it's such a difficult concept to define that there's no unanimity in terms of the definition. And the cultural variance is one of the issues at play in that. But I think you can, even given cultural variation, there are, again, to come back to these certain qualities, compassion, that fellow feeling for emotional regulation in terms of approaching decisions and so on, I think those are kind of cross-cultural. I think those extend to many different cultures. And what I tried to do was get a sense of things that sort of applied over multiple cultural backgrounds. Having said that, interestingly enough, culture is a really important part of evolution, too. So it's an important form of knowledge, and knowledge is an important component in wisdom. Mimicry is an important part of culture, and mimicry is an important part of compassion and empathy. So, again, there's a little bit of overlap in some of these ideas, but it's an important question. But I think there are certain intrinsic qualities to wisdom that kind of extend beyond different cultures.
I just have trouble putting wisdom together with ethnic hatred, as I see in the Balkans.
Right, but I don't think ethnic hatred is particularly wise.
Well, of course not.
All right. Well, thank you for
enough.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go into a caller here, line two. This is Urbana. Hello.
I hear that recently people were expressing anger that President Obama was not expressing more anger about the BP oil spill.
Right.
And wondered if you thought he qualified for being on the path towards wisdom. Even at his young age.
Yeah, interesting that you asked that. Among other things, I've been trying to continue the conversation about wisdom in a blog that I've been doing. And one of the blog posts was sort of asking the question, is Obama wise? Or what qualities does he possess that seems to lend themselves to wisdom? And one of them was this kind of emotional equanimity in the face of uncertainty or dealing with things. The website, if you're curious, is www.stephensshall.com. But that was one of the issues. Another was his sort of information-gathering traits, where he seems to be he doesn't ask only for information that will flatter his opinions, but basically challenge his opinions as well, at least from some of the coverage that I've read. So I thought that in terms of again, that idea of establishing value before making a decision, that depends on the information that comes in. I think he's rather voracious in his information acquisition. There's an interesting story in the Washington Post a couple months ago about the letters that his staff provides him from general members of the public, and he insists that at least half of them be critical and not complimentary because he wants to know what people are thinking that disagree with him, which I think is a really important component of this. And he's very resilient. I think the healthcare legislation that I also wrote about is, he just didn't give up on that, and he kept pursuing it very civilly, which I think is an important component of it, not yielding to the anger that I'm sure he privately may have felt when things looked like they were falling apart. And I think that was a degree, an element in the success of him getting that legislation passed. You know, whether you like the legislation or not, that's a whole other issue. But the point is that actually making the accomplishment, I think, was served by some of these qualities, yeah.
And on the other side, just identifying somebody living who is wise, I don't think anybody would argue that Jimmy Carter is not wise.
Is not wise.
You would not argue that he was not wise. Sorry, I'm
Or that you'd argue
negative.
That he was
he
was wise.
I think he is.
Yes.
Whether he was or not, I don't know, but he is.
Yeah, no, I think he's a, very interesting example because, you know, on the public stage when he was president, I don't think those qualities were appreciated much at all, frankly.
No. No, but he seems to be doing well now.
But I always thought his perspective was very interesting, and it's almost like you can't afford to be wise as a politician these days. In part because you can't tell people, if you remember the famous malaise argument, you can't tell people what they don't want to hear and be a successful politician.
Yeah.
And yet, as we've talked about, you know, being a little bit adversarial toward your society is actually one of the marks of wisdom in terms of perceiving something that people don't want to hear about.
We have about a minute and a half, and if you will forgive me for asking you such a big question with not very much time, I'm sure that one of the things that people always ask you is, well, based on now what you have learned in the process of writing this book, can you talk about things an individual can do to try to cultivate wisdom?
Well, as I, you know, alluded to earlier, and frankly, it was the main motivation for the book in a way, is I think thinking about wisdom, wrestling with its definition, testing its ideas against how you lead your own life, I think is a really important step in just getting you to stop and think about what it means and how it might be a part of your life. And so, in a sense, I wanted the book to be, almost a page-by-page, not provocation, but maybe instigation to think about how people feel about their own lives. And frankly, I've been very gratified by some of the reader response. It's had precisely that effect. It's really forced people to stop, think about what's really important in their lives, how they make decisions, and maybe how they can maybe approach problems or decisions in a different way in the future. So I think it begins with thinking about it, just the way philosophy really forced us to think about what is really important in our lives and how little we spend on philosophy now. But it's really the whole point of philosophy, which means literally love of wisdom, is how does one conduct one's life in the best way? And I think we get away from that because we're so busy with other things. We're getting through the day, but it's really important to think about.
Yeah. Well, as is often the case here on the show, we've just skated on the surface of something that is really deep and interesting. And if you want to read more, you look for the book that's titled Wisdom from Philosophy to Neuroscience by our guest Stephen S. Hall, published by Knopf. And Mr. Hall, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast on the 7th of June. We're sorry that the program that we had scheduled, a conversation with Jacob Hacker from Yale talking about the Economic Security Index. We're sorry that didn't happen. We just weren't able to hook up with him, but we'll see if we can get that rescheduled, and we'll be able to do that on another day. And, of course, if you'd like to listen to past interviews, just go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now located at 27 East Marketview Drive in Marketview Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music.
That's it for us on Focus. Stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, September, wheat trading at 714 and three quarters, down 8 3/4. December, 729 and a half, down 8 1/2. In Chicago, September wheat, 683 and three quarters, down 18 3/4. December, 716 and a quarter, down 18. September corn, 415 and a quarter, up 3 1/2. December, 430 and a half, up 3 1/4. March, 443, make that 444, up 3 1/2. May, 450 and three quarters, up 3 1/2. September beans, 1047 and three quarters, up 4 1/4. November, 1045 and a half, up 1 1/2. January, 1051 and a quarter, up 3/4. March, 1052 and a half, up 3/4. September meal, 306 even, up 330. September oil, 4201, down 51. August live cattle, 95.77 and a half, up 145. October, 96.95, up 187.